Well, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very sorry I arrived today. I was not able to attend the previous days of the conference, but I just returned from a 2-month sabbatical in Munich, and I'm happy that I'm I was able to make it to the conference today. I will actually, the title is maybe pretty detailed. It talks about connecting quantum systems to optimize photonics. I mean, the topic of this conference is implementation of quantum simulators. The open questions at the end, and also the talk itself will talk about our progress and thoughts on how to implement quantum simulator based on color centers in solids, optically connected color centers in solids. That's what we're working on, but we're not there yet. That's what I would like to discuss more with the rest of you. But what I'll be talking about is actually implementation of experimental platform and investigation of various color centers and optical connections. So you'll see a lot of details of our experimental effort here. And as you all know, in order to implement a variety of quantum technologies, and that includes quantum simulators, but also quantum networks, we need homogeneous qubits with optical interfaces, and also we need efficient optical interconnects. And I would like to say that this all could be generalized as well to superconducting platforms where you just replace optical with microwave connections. But as you're scaling system up, you have to worry about all of the connections and not losing photons or microwave photons along the way, and also implementing the whole scalable platform in such a way that you can solve interesting problems. So I'll start by saying a few words about our work on picking the right qubits with optical interfaces and investigation of a variety of qubits, and then I will talk about optical connections, which is something that we've been working on for a long time, but it's becoming a more pressing issue now, or more recently, as we're working towards scaling the systems beyond 2 qubits or so. So for a long time, for a while, my group worked on indium arsenide quantum dots in gallium arsenide as qubits with good optical interfaces. Indium arsenide quantum dot is just a chunk of indium arsenide inside of gallium arsenide, and then we would make a resonator by drilling 2-dimensional arrays of holes inside of this gallium arsenide slab. And this localizes field into very small optical mode volume below cubic optical wavelength with high quality factors. And also line width of the quantum dot itself, of excitonic transition in quantum dot, is pretty small. And we've been able to routinely reach the strong coupling regime of cavity quantum electrodynamics, where the coupling strengths exceed loss rates of the system. I will not really talk about details of these experiments for the reasons that will become obvious pretty soon. But I'd like to say a few words about some of the more recent experiments we performed that include generation of quantum states of light. And of course, you know, once you reach the strong coupling regime, you can measure transmission through the system. Here, for example, you see transmission as we're tuning quantum dot relative to the cavity resonance. We change the tuning by changing temperature, but there are other more scalable methods than this. And since the system is strongly coupled, you see anti-crossing, and you can extract all the parameters of the system from this. And for these particular systems, and in general for color centers as well that I'll be talking about, the rates are in the range of gigahertz, tens of gigahertz, so everything actually is pretty, pretty fast, much faster than atomic systems. So once the system is strongly coupled, of course, you have a ladder of dress states. It's not only the first rung that I showed, but there are higher rungs as well. So we explored a variety of effects, including photon blockade, photon tunneling, where you drive different manifolds of the ladder resonantly. And since these eigenstates are formed by entangling your artificial atom quantum dot with some fixed number of photons, 1, 2, and so on, and since the ladder is unharmonic, as many of you know, I'm sure, you will observe a change in the statistics of light that is transmitted through the system. So as an example, when we drive resonantly first rung of the ladder, since this is formed by entangling one photon with a quantum dot, once you couple that photon, because of the ladder unharmonicity, there will be no eigenstates to couple other additional photons from the input laser. So once the first photon is coupled, all the other photons are blocked from entering. So in transmission, you will observe, ideally, a single photon stream. And you can do that also for a detuned system where you have even additional unharmonicity. So we measured this many times, first time in 2008, but we kind of refined the results over 8 years or so. Here is an example of the second order correlation. This is photon statistics measurement at the output. You see strong suppression of multiphoton pulses. I mean, it's not a coherent statistics anymore. And we also measured the indistinguishability of the photons that are transmitted by using Hong Wu Mandel type experiments, and we extract indistinguishability of 96%. So you really see a change in the statistics of light. It's not Poissonian, but strongly sub-Poissonian. This is one of my favorite experiments, actually, we performed with this platform. And I'd like to say that the photon blockade in this platform was demonstrated in 2008 by our team, which was 3 years after Jeff Kimball's experiments at Caltech, and roughly the same time as the experiments by Gerhard Rempe at MPQ. A few years before circuitry, the experiments led by Andreas Wollraff, who is here also, speaking at this conference. And you may wonder then, you know, why, what happened, right? Why these systems didn't scale as well as circuit QED systems that have, you know, shown amazing success. Well, the problem is that indium arsenide quantum dots are not very uniform, right? They're not really lithographically defined. They're self-assembled. And there is no way to control their shapes and sizes during growth. We learned how to control their positions without degrading them, but they're very, very small, orders of magnitude smaller than Josephson junctions and lithographically defined qubits. So in this case, you know, your potential is defined really by the shape and size of the quantum dot. And since you cannot really control that, when you look at the transitions of different quantum dots on the chip, this is what you would see. And this spectral broadening is basically 40 to 60 nanometers, right? So it's a very, very nice individual emitter. Some of the best quantum light sources are based on indium arsenide quantum dots. But if you would like to build anything on chip, anything scalable, quantum simulator, quantum networks, you know, quantum computers, anything like that, you cannot really do that because you cannot really tune quantum dots to resonances with each other. And, you know, we spent about 3 years trying to actually couple two quantum dots to the same cavity, and we failed for the reasons that are shown here. And we started then working on color centers in solids, which are also optically interfaced, but they are more atom-like. In particular, we've been investigating two families of color centers, silicon and more recently tin vacancy in diamond, which is shown here. This is silicon vacancy, but tin vacancy is pretty much the same. So you have two missing carbon atoms and then one extra silicon impurity in between. This is the energy level structure of the system, and this is the spectrum of a single silicon vacancy at 4 Kelvin temperature. And the other category of color centers that we've been looking into in collaboration with Jörg Rachtrup, who is also here and who gave a talk, and I'm sure he spoke about it. We've been looking into silicon vacancies in 4H polytype of silicon carbide. And this is the spectrum, again, at low temperature, energy level structure. And depending which silicon atom in the lattice is missing, you can observe V1 and V2 color centers, which are around 900 nanometer wavelength. And that's really good for us because indium arsenide quantum dots that we studied for 15 years are also in the same range of wavelength. So we have the whole lab to do these experiments. So let me tell you a little bit about our progress on these color centers and where we stand, and I'll start with silicon vacancy in diamond. So with silicon vacancy of diamond, we already have excellent photonic interfaces. I'll tell you more about these experiments in a moment. I'm just summarizing where we stand. So we have excellent photonic interfaces. We have only up to 30 gigahertz of spectral broadening on the chip. Between different silicon vacancies on the chip. And here you see spectrum in red of a single silicon vacancy, and then in black is an ensemble of silicon vacancies on the chip. So broadening is only 30 gigahertz, much smaller than quantum dots that I showed you a few slides back. And as of recently, we also know how to compensate for up to 100 gigahertz of spectral broadening by Raman driving, by Raman scattering from the system. So we can actually compensate for all of the spectral broadening by using, for example, Raman scattering. And I'll tell you now about all of this in a moment. But I hope this relays to you a message that, in principle, we have all the tools necessary to interface any two color centers on the same chip, something that we haven't been able to do with quantum dots in the past. So I mentioned 30 gigahertz of spectral broadening. This is the result that is based on our CVD-grown material. This was done in collaboration with groups of Ziyak Shen, Nick Milosh, and Steve Chu at Stanford, who helped with the growth. We start with high-purity diamond substrate, and then grow silicon-doped diamond film on top. And some of the other groups, and also our group, have also worked on ion-implanted diamond materials. Ion implantation is a little bit more damaging to the lattice, and we've seen smallest distribution in CVD growth case, but I think that also ion implantation is something that could be controlled and tuned better. So here we grow material, silicon-doped film, on top of high-purity diamond. Then we fabricate an array of pillars that are about 200 nanometers wide. These rectangles here are just lines that we use so that we could position, we could actually image pillars, locate them inside of a cryostat. All the measurements that you see are done at 4 Kelvin. We did statistical analysis of the array. Of course, silicon vacancies are not basically in this case grown on precisely defined positions, but they would be only in pillars, right? And considering that this is a statistical process, some of the pillars would not contain silicon vacancies. But we've been able to measure 31% of the pillars containing exactly one silicon vacancy, as confirmed from the second order correlation measurements. This is how the spectrum of a single silicon vacancy would look like. 6% of the pillars for the dose that we used in the growth contained two or more emitters. This is an example of a pillar with two or more emitters, so you see multiple lines. And the rest of the pillars didn't contain any emitters, right? And I think this is something that could be improved, and in particular with ion implantation, but it's already pretty good, and you could actually, you have enough pillars that you could try connecting or working with them. So then when you look at the spectrum of a single silicon vacancy in red, again, this is around 740 nanometers versus ensemble in black on the same chip, we extract from that 30 gigahertz of broadening. And that's the number that I gave you on the previous slide, much smaller than for indium arsenide, gallium arsenide quantum dots. And that's the primary reason why we're focusing on these color centers, because otherwise indium arsenide, gallium arsenide quantum dots have pretty much perfect internal quantum efficiency, no phonon sideband. So in principle, they're much better than any of the color centers we work with, but they're not really scalable. But as individual emitters, they're of higher efficiency. So we've done also ultrafast coherent control of individual silicon vacancies. Here I'm basically talking about using optical pulses to put the system into the arbitrary superposition of the ground and excited states, and we're able to do that. These are experimental results of Rabi and Ramsey measurements. Again, this is a superposition of the ground and excited state, so lifetime of this is still pretty short. It's about 200 picoseconds, as you can see here. We're working on trying to do ultra-fast optical control of the spin states of the system. Nobody has done that yet. People have done it using continuous wave lasers for the initialization of the spin states. They've done microwave control, but nobody has done ultra-fast optical control. And we're working towards that and trying to figure out whether that would work in this particular system. But this is something that we and others have done for a long time in indium arsenide, gallium arsenide quantum dots, and it's quite powerful because with a single 100 picosecond pulse, you can essentially manipulate the spin states in the system. So it's very fast, and it's very also scalable. So then another thing that I mentioned is photon interface for silicon vacancies in diamond. I mentioned that we already have excellent optical interface. Here we fabricate optical resonators around silicon vacancies. This fabrication, actually etching step, was done in Harvard in the group of Marco Launcher using their angled etching method which results in these resonators that have triangular cross-section. So that just the last step was done at Harvard. Everything before was done at Stanford. But I'll show you later on some of the more recent fabrication that we developed at Stanford that it leads to more generalized shapes of the structures. And again, this is pretty challenging here because you're working with a block of diamond. And diamond is a hard material to process. So you have to fabricate kind of three-dimensional structures, carve them out in a block of diamond, which is not trivial. It's not like you have silicon sitting on insulator, so you just do lithography and etch another cut. So inside of these resonators, we have narrow line width. We measure narrow line width around 300 megahertz, which is comparable to bulk color centers in bulk diamonds. So no degradation of the line width, as is always present for nitrogen vacancies. These inversion symmetric color centers are immune to static electric fields. And then we also show that we can isolate single color centers, and we have high quality cavities, in this case with a quality factor of around 9,000. And then we tune cavity resonance to different transitions of the color center. So this is the two-dimensional image that I showed previously. We tune cavity onto different transitions, and we see that they light up. And obviously, system is not strongly coupled yet because you don't see anti-crossing. Nobody has measured anti-crossing yet, so it's not at the same stage of photon interfaces as indium arsenide quantum dots, but we're optimistic that we should get there pretty soon. So for off-resonance system from the cavity, you see the spectrum of a color center shown here in green. And when one of the transitions is resonant with the cavity, you see significant enhancement in emission of the resonant transition. And it's, in this particular case, 42-fold increase in photoluminescence. We also measure lifetime on and off resonance, and from the significant reduction in lifetime, and by knowing branching ratios in the system, actually we know that the Purcell enhancement should be much, much larger than 10. So that's pretty good. Again, system is not strongly coupled yet. Coupling is not exceeding loss rates of the system, but we should be able to improve cavity quality factor and mode volume by a factor of 2. Which should lead to strong coupling. So although system is not strongly coupled, we are already in the regime where a single color center inside of the cavity, single atom inside of the cavity, changes transmission through the system. So here, for example, you see transmission through the cavity when color center is detuned. This is just inverted Lorentzian, and then when color center is tuned on resonance, you see a dip, or peak, because it's inverted dip, induced in the cavity resonance. And from this, you can also extract the cooperativity of the system, which here measured at temperature of 4 Kelvin was 1.4. But then when you cool the system down to 100 millikelvin temperature, which was the measurement done at Harvard with pretty much the same system parameters, you see cooperativity of 20. So everything works much better at lower temperatures. For silicon vacancy, you have to work in dilution refrigerators. And the reason why you have to do that will be explained in a moment. But that's unfortunate, I would say, thing with these particular color centers, that they don't really work as well in closed cycle cryostats. So only at 100 millikelvin temperatures, you would see narrow line widths, large cooperativity, and long electron spin coherence times. So again, I mentioned 30 gigahertz spectral broadening, good photonic interface. How do we compensate for that spectral broadening in order to interface two color centers on the chip? So we showed that you could do Raman driving, which basically means that you just take a laser and drive the system off resonantly, and you change the detuning from the excited state, and then you scatter a photon into the cavity resonance, which is basically detuned from this other transition. And as we change the laser detuning from the excited state by up to 100 gigahertz, which is much larger than the spectral broadening of the system, which is 30 gigahertz, we see that we can tune the frequency of the Raman scattered photon. And this tells you that you can actually just take two lasers and drive any two color centers on the chip or any number of color centers on the chip with different lasers in the extreme scenario and have these Raman scattered photons all on resonance with each other, and you can use them to entangle different color centers and different spins and make scalable structures. So we have excellent optical interface, we have pretty homogeneous qubits, and we also have a technique that we can use to compensate for all the spectral broadening in the system. So the state of the art is interaction of two silicon vacancies inside of the same cavity. That's the work that was done recently at Harvard in the reference that was on previous slide. It was not really, it was random process because they identified the cavity that had two color centers that they could tune on resonance with each other with magnetic fields. So it's not really a scalable system. But I think that with the techniques that I'm showing here and what I showed you previously, it's obvious that you could do interaction of two or more color centers in a more scalable manner by driving them with different lasers and move it beyond two. So I said that silicon vacancies work better when you cool them down, as my friend Marco Launcher would say, when you blue force the system, when you put it in dilution refrigerator, it works better. And the reason for that is that the ground state splitting of the system is only 50 gigahertz. So you have to really cool it down to millikelvin temperatures in order to suppress phonon mixing of the ground state and dephasing. And since we did the experiments at 4 Kelvin, which is where KT is significantly larger than 50 gigahertz, there is no surprise that we actually didn't really see as good cooperativities and as a narrow line width as people would see at millikelvin temperatures. But there are also other issues with silicon vacancy, which is that internal quantum efficiency is relatively small. This tells you that depending on the reference, but in optimistic case, only in up to 30% of the excitation events, you're getting a photon at the output. In other 70 or more percent of excitation events, you're just getting phonons, right? So you're not even emitting photons. And that's concerning. So we started looking into other color centers, and in particular, I will not really talk about the ones that we're not so excited about, but we're very excited about thin vacancy. Thin vacancy has exactly the same structure as silicon vacancy, a little bit shorter wavelength. It has 850 gigahertz ground state splitting, which means that you should be able to work in closed cycle cryostat at few Kelvin temperatures, no problem. And that's still easier and more scalable for these optics experiments than working in dilution refrigerator. Then also, it has higher internal quantum efficiency, reported to be between 80 and 90%. But again, this is a relatively new field, and there is still work on characterization ongoing, and I'll show you some of the early characterizations that we did, but it looks better than silicon vacancy. So if all continues to work well, we should be able to observe exactly the same results as for silicon vacancies, but at elevated temperatures, and that's really desirable. So we recently did characterization of thin vacancy in diamond pillars. The work will be published soon, but at pretty much the same time, there was another paper posted on archive in collaboration between the groups of Dirk Englund and Mette Ataturre, who I think was also here, and they observed pretty much the same results. So this is the predicted energy level structure on the system. We implanted thin vacancies, isolated individual ones in the pillars, as you see from statistics measurements. We measure a line width, again, this was at 1.6 Kelvin temperature and 4 Kelvin temperature. Line width is 230 megahertz, comparable to silicon vacancies in diamond, not degraded by putting them in the structures. And we also did magneto optical spectroscopy in magnetic fields up to 9 Tesla. Transitions that we extracted in the process, all of the energy level structure, line widths, everything actually matches the theoretical predictions, both in our work and the work from MIT and Cambridge. So we're quite optimistic that also at these higher temperatures of few Kelvin, we should observe electron spin coherence times that are measured for silicon vacancies at millikelvin temperatures. So moving forward, we'll primarily focus on thin vacancies unless we discover something undesirable in the process. So the other set of color centers that we've been looking into have been thin silicon vacancies in silicon carbide. And Again, this is a close collaboration with the Jörg Rachterup team, and Jörg has probably covered some of their work on this. This is a missing silicon atom in 4H polytype of silicon carbide. Depending on the location of the missing atom, you see V1 or V2 color centers in the range around 900 nanometers. In the earlier work, collaboration work that is cited here, since silicon carbide is also a very tough material to process, and this particular polytype only comes as a block of uniform material, you have to figure out how to carve three-dimensional structures so that you could localize localized field inside of it. Then I should hurry up. So we could only make pillars, but more recently we've come up with better ideas how to actually fabricate structures, and we've developed so-called silicon carbide on insulator, where we're able to fabricate photonic structures, kind of like thin down silicon carbide layer, put it on low index substrate, and fabricate very high quality photonics. And I'll show you some of the more recent results on that, which are quite exciting. But even when we just make pillars on this platform, we see much cleaner spectrum for V1 and V2 transitions, narrow line widths, we get rid of the background. So we kind of know now that we should be able to fabricate the whole photonics and interface color centers without problems to each other. So that's the whole discussion of color centers and finding homogeneous qubits. But there is the other part of the story, which is efficient optical connections. And that's a big problem when you're scaling systems up, because often in quantum optics, we work with the interfaces that have very low efficiency. And I'm illustrating this with some of the work from my group. But interestingly, even in commercial photonics, people work with interfaces that have efficiencies on the order of about 40% or so, which is okay if you have milliwatts of power in a laser, but for quantum optics certainly is not good at all. And you know, people have measured higher efficiencies with fiber tapers, but fiber tapers, using fiber taper for each color center in the cryostat is not exactly scalable. So we're trying to develop much higher efficiency photonics so that we could actually build scalable systems. And this is something we've been working on for a really long time, more than 10 years. About 6 years ago, we had a breakthrough in terms of designing high efficiency photonics for a particular role and function. Since we combine classical optimization techniques with photonic design, the resulting structures are completely non-intuitive. And this is an example of a wavelength splitter, but they are much better performing because we incorporate environmental errors, fabrication constraints, fabrication errors into the design process. So you have a much higher yield of high efficiency devices in this case. And I'll just explain you briefly what we're doing and show you some of the results and finish with how this impacts our quantum optics work. So let's say you would like to do mode converter, which converts first order mode to second order mode. You can do it on chip or free space. I mean, this morning there were also discussions of multi-mode cavity QED. You could actually do any spatial mode converters that would be of relevance for the experiments that people do with different spatial modes, but I'll illustrate with on-chip configuration. So normally people would on-chip do this conversion by a adiabatic mode conversion, which takes many hundreds of microns of the footprint, but we wanted to do it in many orders of magnitude smaller footprint with very high efficiency. So if you would like to explore whether a solution exists, you may just discretize this into some sort of pixels and try all the combinations of refractive index materials that you can use in your experiment. But the problem is that parameter space is very large. And for this particular problem, and for these coarse pixels, it would be 10 to the power of 112. So there is no way you could run these many simulations, because we're doing all of this design in three dimensions. So this is, in your lifetime, you will not be able to run this many of them. So what we do instead is explore the full parameter space, but we actually are guided by the physics of the problem. And I'll show you a movie of how the design looks like. And you'll see the first stage where you continuously vary refractive index and you end up with mode converter, but this is not something that you can make. And then you do binary optimization, and again, you have a mode converter. This is something you can make. The first phase is just initialization. And for three-dimensional device of this size, because there is a third dimension that you don't see in the picture, 400 iterations, and each one includes two electromagnetic simulations on gaming GPUs, take about an hour. And that's much faster, of course, than commercial electromagnetic solvers, because we developed also high-speed solvers to do this. And of course, this we're working on in collaboration with Google on trying to speed this up further. So again, you can design different things. These are different wavelength splitters, not really quantum optics device, but they work really remarkably well without any post-tuning. You measure transmission characteristics for a lot of them on the same chip. They all work the same because you incorporate fabrication constraints into the design process. And we recently released open source version of this software suite, which includes electromagnetic solver on GitHub, and some of you may already be using it. Some people in industry are using for classical photonics as well, but the open source version has been also used by many people in the community. So we've done a lot of things in classical photonics. I don't, in the interest of time, I'll actually skip all of that and just close with how it impacts quantum optics work. One of the things that it has enabled that we haven't been able to do otherwise is on-chip electron acceleration, on-chip particle acceleration. So we just designed the structures and we couple laser beams and we see acceleration as a result of actually optimizing the structure for this electron accelerator. So we accelerate 80 kilo electron volt electrons in 30 microns by about 1.5 kilo electron volt. So this is something we couldn't really do without optimization techniques because we didn't really have classical photonic devices for those to solve this problem. But in quantum optics, it's even more remarkable, in my opinion. So I'll show you examples of how it works in diamond. So these are all diamond structures that we've optimized and we measure now with color centers. And let's show coupler for start. This is how we and other people in the community typically couple light into resonators. It's only 1% efficiency structure. In the same footprint, if you computer optimize couplers, you can go to 25% efficiency or more. And this is just constrained by very rough fabrication constraints. It should be even better. So these are measured devices. All of them perform the same. If you do experiments with optimized couplers on the cavity, in 1 second integration, you see much stronger cavity signal. If you actually use these unoptimized couplers that we used in our experiments and others have used in their experiments, after 10 seconds integration, you barely start to see the cavity. So there is no hope that you could scale anything without optimized interfaces up to a larger number of atoms. And then we are going further. I mean, we have couplers, optimized beam splitters, resonators with color centers, recombiners. I mean, structures of this type could be used to entangle multiple color centers. We're working on it. Then also in silicon carbide platform that I mentioned before, we also have optimized couplers with waveguides coupled to resonators. Again, you see non-intuitive couplers here. We have very high quality silicon carbide. We have quality factors of a few hundred thousand, which is higher than what people have measured even at telecommunication wavelengths in this material. So that's a result of this new process that we developed, and we also have high-quality color centers inside of the material. These are other types of resonators, also high Q factor, small mode volume, also in silicon carbide with optimized interfaces. And we measured basically coupling of color center to silicon carbide resonator. We see, as you see, it lights up when they're on resonance, so it's enhanced by a factor of 100 or more. And we extract strong Purcell enhancement of 9 or more. So I'm wrapping it up. So where are we going from here? Again, we don't have a quantum simulator yet, but we want to do interaction of multiple color centers, and I'll finish with what we plan to do and open questions. We will never really have precise positions of color centers as you have in optical lattices, because implantation or process will never be perfect. But we can fabricate resonators or any optical structures with color centers, find where they are, and then instead of optical tweezers that you have in your optical lattices, we can do reconfiguration layer on top, which would be fabricated in another deposited material, silicon nitride, and then that reconfiguration layer would be used to connect color centers that work. So these are our optical tweezers. And this is completely doable. This is just two layers of lithography, so not a problem at all to scale it up. We are also collaborating with a group of Ignacio Sirac on the ideas to implement quantum simulators in these structures. This is primarily inspired by their proposals from several years ago on putting atomic arrays close to photonic structures. And in this case, you can achieve interaction beyond nearest neighbor because the range of interaction is controlled by the curvature of your photonic bandgap structure. And since we have complete control of the curvature of photonic bandgap structure, and also our atoms are fixed inside of the lattice as opposed to real atoms where these experiments couldn't be done for the reason of having them not at fixed positions relative to 100 nanometer time scales of the structure, we think that solid state emitters should actually be pretty suitable for implementation of these proposals. And as I said, you know, we can really control the range of interaction or Hamiltonian that would be simulated by controlling dispersion of the system. I mean, by brute force, you cannot really draw omega k relation desired for a particular range of interaction and optimize the structure to achieve it. But if you let computer optimize it for you, then you can achieve any dispersion that you like. And we're already measuring the structures that have desired dispersion. So this is one of the dispersion engineered resonators that would be also of relevance for frequency comps. So with that, I'd like to actually just summarize that I think that in scaling these solid state systems, color centers with optical interfaces and optimization techniques would be pretty important. And I think that also photonic optimization techniques would be very important for other approaches to implementation of quantum simulators. And I'd like to finish with open questions that I also uploaded online yesterday. I think the main open question is it possible to build quantum simulators using optically interfaced artificial atoms, such as color centers in photonic structures? I'm very optimistic that this is possible, especially after some of the recent discussions we've had with Ignacio Sirac and his team and recent developments in color centers. These are advantages. You can control interaction beyond nearest neighbor. They're at fixed positions, naturally trapped by crystal. Engineering Hamiltonian could be achieved by optimizing photonic structure. And if scaling is possible, then building a simulator with millions of color centers is not any more difficult than building a simulator with 10 atoms. I mean, we don't have any issues making structures bigger. But of course, main challenges are overcoming spectral broadening of the system and imperfection of artificial atoms. And also, I don't think we'll have quantum microscope for solid state systems. So our experiments will be constrained for doing correlations between different atoms. But there is a lot that could be done in that case as well. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for the talk. Questions?
Yeah. Can you elaborate a bit more on this dispersion engineering?
Yeah.
You were mentioning in
yes.
the last slide.
Yes. Yes, I ran through it very quickly, but it's exactly based on same type of optimization techniques. So for it's very important not only for quantum simulators, but also for nonlinear optics. This is dispersion of the photonic structure. And for those of you who are not really familiar with photonic crystals, I mean, it's completely equivalent to energy band diagram of solids, right? So you have frequency of photons versus wave vector in a periodic material. So if you try to just achieve some slow, low group velocity, flat dispersion, which is important for increasing the interaction strength, by brute forcing, moving holes around and so on, you cannot really do that well. I mean, you can achieve slow group velocity in small region, but you will deviate from it eventually. Here, we literally drew dispersion that we were wanting to achieve under the light line. We loaded this as initial condition and then computer optimized together with the fabrication constraints in three dimensions, and you see that you exactly follow the desired dispersion. And you can do that at multiple frequencies. So this is important for nonlinear optics, quantum simulation, but also for on-chip frequency comps. In on-chip frequency comps, since you don't really start from linear dispersion, you have non-uniform separation of different frequencies, which is very important for metrology. But if you engineer linear dispersion and close it with a resonator, then you can improve also frequency comps. And that's what we've been doing here. So again, this is not something that you can intuitively design, but if you computer optimize, you have a much more linear dispersion than in traditional case, which means that your frequency comb is better. But interestingly, the same structure is also used to achieve interaction in quantum simulator beyond nearest neighbor, because the flatter the band, the larger the interaction range. That's according to the paper by Sirac and collaborators. And I ran through it. I should say that there has been a lot of very remarkable effort on implementing these proposals using atoms coupled to photonic crystals in the group of Jeff Kimball at Caltech. But they haven't really been able to do to obtain results yet, because atoms, the photonic crystal itself has periodicity of around 200 nanometers. And you have to fix atoms at particular positions relative to the field. Since atoms are moving, then in the averaged results, you don't really see any effects. The advantage of doing this with solid-state systems is they're at fixed positions, and you will have some defects inside of the structure, but they're completely random, and you can make multiple trips. But you will not have issues that you have if you work with atomic physics systems. Yeah.
Other questions?
Yes.
So I'm trying to understand what are the ultimate limitations of this scheme.
Yeah.
In the sense that the radiative losses are under control with the clever design of the photonic structure.
Yes, you can. That is under control. Dispersion is under control.
So you have no radiative losses of the color center. These are the last dangerous item.
Yes, because that's the scheme that I was talking about is also related to some of the things that you've done, of course, in the past that you're also interested in, where you couple color centers or quantum emitters to resonators, and they're in photon blockade regime. Mm-hmm. But here, emitters are in photonic band gap, close to the flat band, which means that you are suppressing radiative loss, but then still coupling them to evanescent tail of the mm-hmm. the band. So I think, in principle, these schemes, your proposals and their proposals, are very similar in terms of what Hamiltonians you can implement, both Hilbert Hamiltonian. I viewed Ignacio's proposals as maybe a little bit simpler for experimental implementation, because your atoms kind of define the cavity.
Yes.
But other than that, it's exactly the same thing.
But still, no radiative losses from the emitters are dangerous.
They're suppressed, but this is a two-dimensional band gap, right? So then you have spontaneous emission rate suppression by, experimentally, we demonstrated a factor of 8, because you still have continuum of states above the light line, right? It's not a full suppression, it's not three-dimensional system.
Okay, so they're radiative. But the non-radiative, those are...
Non-radiative, that depends on the emitter that you are having. Silicon vacancy would have pretty strong non-radiative loss. Tin vacancy would not really
90%
have. 90% efficiency, which is why I'm more optimistic about tin vacancy than silicon vacancy. Plus, these experiments are easier to do in closed cycle Kravstad, which is another reason. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
One last question. Yeah. Just one very quick one. If you can go back to the single silicon center, when you were comparing the lifetimes.
Yes.
Because besides the kind of three orders of magnitude difference in the lifetime, so it was...
For the experimental, silicon vacancy, yeah.
Yeah, that one.
This one,
right.
Yeah.
It looks like also the way it is... the dependence on time is... different in the two cases, or it is an...
Yeah.
Do you have an explanation for that?
I mean, this is, again, done at 4 Kelvin temperature, and silicon vacancy has kind of complicated these 4 levels, right, and different branching ratios into all of the transitions. So when we were, in this particular case, we were doing above-resonant excitation, above-band excitation, and spectrally filtering particular transitions. But it's possible that something else was collected for this off-resonant case, because it's pretty dim, right? This is where you your cavity is not really helping you. And then you see kind of single exponential in the case when it's resonant with the cavity, where it's clear that we're spectrally filtering one transition and it's very different from the background, right? So I think the reason is, you know, again, this is normalized to one, but the counts are much, much smaller in this case, because you have a you have no cavity helping you. But having that said, it's a factor of 10 difference because there is a branching ratio and you're just measuring intensity decay, and that's also influenced by the decay into all of the other transitions. So this is lower limit on the Purcell enhancement would be 10. When you take into account branching ratios that we measured, spontaneous emission rate enhancement for this transition is a factor of 30 or more.
Perfect.
Thank you.
So thank the speaker again.